CosmicRadio.tv. Welcome to Cinematography. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas, joined by...
Brant Hughes.
Brant, what are you doing?
Brant Hughes.
What are you doing? That's a rock band mic.
Oh.
That's not even one of our OM2s. That's just some random rock band mic where you can play some karaoke right now.
You gotta tell me this before we start.
Are you just gonna hold on to that? Is that your...
Yep.
That's your walking stick.
Actually, that would probably... What?
This is crazy, yeah. What? We have a boom mic now, so we're free. We're able to do things.
Don't break the fourth wall that much.
No, like, hey, look.
It's just magic.
Well, I mean, you know.
This is how video works. It's
yes, exactly. Magic. Exactly. It's all just one giant continuous shot.
Wow.
Today,
good segue.
Exactly, because today we're doing our reaction to Oscar-nominated film,
that's
Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Birdman, my new superhero, coming out next week.
I'm not going to lie, when this movie got announced, I thought, and I didn't see a trailer, didn't even hear much about it.
Right.
I was like, are they making a Birdman movie? Like Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law kind of thing?
That'd be pretty awesome.
That would've been pretty amazing too, but I'm like, I did not know what to expect. So I had watched this earlier in theaters with my parents when I was in Dallas a couple months ago. I was kind of sick, so I didn't even get a chance to watch it again. So this is my second time watching it, but this is your first.
Mm-hmm.
What was your initial thought? And before we continue, by the way, this is very good, be very spoiler ridden. This is our typical reaction.
Full on spoilers.
So if you've not seen the film, go grab it. It's digital on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, wherever you want to watch it. Go watch it now. That's the only thing I think we can both say safely right now that we both loved it.
Yes.
Okay.
Couldn't be easier. Go watch it.
All right.
Bow.
So anyways.
So I have far more good things to say than bad things. So I'll start off with bad things.
Okay.
I had two bad things, but I really only remember one.
Interesting. Oh, this is the first, because usually you have at least more than one bad thing, more than two bad things to say about a film, even if it's one you like.
Sure. I mean, if I sat down and like really watched it and dug into it, I'm sure there would probably be some.
Right, of course.
This one isn't even like a super bad thing. It was just super bad. not that that has anything to do with it. It's just, it was this weird thing. Every time they shot the scene on the roof.
Yes.
With Emma Stone
Oh my God, Edward Norton?
Yes
Edward Norton. Norton, yeah. There we go.
Every time they shot that scene, it looked like it was digitally stabilized. If you pay attention to like the windows and lights in the background, there's kind of a subspace warping that you get with digital stabilization. And I'm just very curious to find out if there was like some weird limitation that they had when shooting in that space specifically, because it would kind of go back and forth between being super incredibly smooth and like in camera smooth and this kind of strange like kind of weird.
See, I wonder if that wasn't an effect, because like the thing I liked about the movie a lot and watching a second time was sort of the blurring of what is real and what is in Thompson's mind, or Birdman's character, you know, Michael Keaton's character.
Right.
Because like there are times where it's hard to tell what is real and what is not in the film.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that was a conscious choice, but you could be right. It could just been digital. Probably was just digital stabilization, especially you as a camera guy.
Maybe, yeah.
Which I should ask, what did you think about the cinematography? Because I know like this is... The one thing I loved about this film was that and yes, if you're smart enough as a film guy, you know where they slipped in the cut, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But just the idea of this film was filmed in one continuous shot is insane.
Sure. And this isn't the first film that's done that. There's Silent House, which...
Okay. So I was trying to remember that this... I know this wasn't the first that did that.
The real first one was, what, like Rope or something? It was a Hitchcock film.
Yes. Well,
it was shot in two takes, but it was stitched together to look like one.
Right. Well, the reason why it was shot... You know why it's shot in two takes, right?
Because of film limitations.
Yeah, they literally ran out of film. They completely... Like, we've hit the canister. There's nothing we can do, you know. But that's what I loved about the film, is that it had this kind of... You know, whenever, like, there were cuts, but the cuts happened basically at, for lack of better words, the dream sequences. You know, either at the point where he had already killed himself, you know, tried to kill himself, or as the movie started, which is sort of a callback to that scene that we'd later get in. But anything that happened in the real world or the movie world, so to speak, was just this one giant continuous shot.
Right. Yeah, it was, for me, as like kind of somebody who's trying to pay a bunch of attention to the production, it was kind of a fun game in and of itself to find where they
could have hit a cut.
And there were a couple times where I felt like it was fairly obvious, but it was seamless enough that it was hard to kind of figure out exactly how they achieved that kind of smooth transition. And also it was just fun, like, imagining all the different places that it could have been, but I wasn't entirely sure because it was, like, so well done.
That's the thing. It was so well done and how they hit it, because, like, I could guess, like, okay, where they're sweeping here, maybe they did a cut, maybe they did it here. Mm-hmm. But even then, it never felt like it was a cut. Like, like you'd have to basically be on the lookout for those things.
Sure, sure.
Which at that point, you're not watching the movie. You're just watching this production.
Yeah, and I feel like the best thing, and it was kind of unexpected for me, that came out of that style of shooting, that kind of long, continuous takes. It was really interesting what they did to kind of play with established conventions of film in that style. I mean, so first of all, you have a really interesting spatial awareness of everything.
Yeah.
Like there's an interesting way that you can tell, like, there are transitions and then there are, like, established shots that they very specifically, like, okay, this character's mark is here.
Like when there's
a mirror here, and you can see the other character through this mirror.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to watch them transition into those, like, kind of established set of shots.
Well, because, like, my favorite stuff was, like, especially when Edward Norton came into the picture and they introduced him, mm-hmm. you know, as he's, like, he's on stage right now, and you can tell time has transitioned a bit. But he's talking, you know, it almost feels like he's talking to the audience because he's just on stage talking. As we find out, he's talking to Keaton's character. Mm-hmm. But the way they sweep in, the way they kind of pan the shot down, it's like he's talking to the audience for a bit. He's having this sort of monologue with us. And then the camera sweeps in. Or even when Emma Stone and Norton's character are on the balcony, not the balcony, I guess the rafters about to make out. It's at times like, who is she talking to? Is she talking to us, the audience? Or is she talking to Edward? Oh, it's Edward Norton. You never realize it because when the camera gets passed, it's not like we're viewing it from a certain character's point of view all the time. We're just a sort of observer that exists here.
Yeah, and one of my favorite bits were, and they did it a couple times, including the time where they're up in the rafters, is when they do, you know, a typical film would have, they would have an interesting way of, they're shooting a scene, and then you start hearing audio bleed in from the next scene, and then it carries through to smooth out the transition of the cutting to the next scene. But here they would do things like, when Keaton was in his room and it's one of the first times you see him kind of telepathically throw something against the wall, and you can hear people talking, and as it pans around, you see a bunch of people in the room that weren't in there previously. And so they, like, did this really fascinating, seamless, like, transition into a different period of time in the same room, in the same shot. And I thought stuff like that was really interesting.
That's one thing I think, you know, above all else with this movie, even if you're not necessarily the biggest fan of these actors, I think above all else, it's just an amazingly shot film. It's just, it's a production that really pushes the boundary of how you present a story in film. So let's get to talking about kind of the characters and the story. For me, the thing I loved about this movie a lot is, one, you know, it's a little bit real when it comes to Michael Keaton, because he's, you know, I mean, he hasn't really done a movie in recent times and he hasn't really done anything. But what I love about this movie is that there's this air of, here's an actor that has been making these, you know, Hollywood blockbuster films, trying to get legitimate from the theater. And it kind of speaks a little true to reality, if that makes any sense.
Sure, yeah.
But what was your take on the whole thing?
At least
not the whole movie, but specifically story.
I thought it was pretty good. It definitely struck true with Keaton and all that stuff. I really liked...
Yeah, who was the character that you enjoyed the most?
Well, more than the characters themselves, what I really enjoyed was the theme of trying to matter and trying to find importance in yourself. And I think that's an interesting philosophical question that kind of, you know, whirs around in my brain all the time. So that really
well, especially in this industry, whether it be Hollywood or even internet things, you're always
internet things.
Well, you know, like what we do, because at the end of the day, we all want someone to tell us that we did a good job. We want to think whatever we did is going to last, especially if you as an artist, you as a creator. Not everyone has those thoughts, you know, like I love that scene where Keaton's like, you're trying to, you know, all your generation's doing is going viral and things like that. And then Emma Stone just dropping some hard
truth bombs,
pretty much a hard truth bomb. And it's tough because you hear Michael Keaton and you hear like, yeah, that's what we want. But then you hear Emma Stone and you're like, yeah, that's also what I want. And it's a hard because you want to matter. You want to be something. You want to be acknowledged you did something good.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to be acknowledged you did something great.
Yeah, I think that's most creators struggle on some level. And, you know, those two characters, they really are going after the same thing, just from different perspectives, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, like, I think... You know, as far as Keaton's character, earlier I mentioned there were two things that I didn't love.
Right.
The second of those things was, and you touched on this earlier, some of the surreal elements of the film, which is interesting because you would think that I would be all
yeah,
up in
I'm about
that
to say, yeah, exactly.
Because I love that. Like, if you give me some Twin Peaks, like weird, like, yeah, like some normal stuff that ends up being super fucking weird, I'm all about that. For me, it danced this weird line for, you know, sometimes it plays into like, oh, this is reality. Sometimes it plays into, oh, this is in his head. And for some reason, it didn't totally land for me. And
okay.
I feel like early on in the film, it was great. Later in the film, it was pretty good. Somewhere in the middle of the film, like when he was flying around the city, for some reason, that just
didn't connect with you.
Yeah, it just didn't work on some level.
It's tough for me because I'm with you on that. Like, I agree that at times it felt a bit jarring. What I liked about it for sure was that when it would sort of reveal that all this is in his head. And I remember the first time they did it was when he was, you know, pissed off at how, you know, a lot of just shit went wrong in one of the preview shows, and he's smashing the room. We're seeing him do this telepathic stuff of, you know, throwing the chair against the wall and all these other things like that. Mm-hmm. But then we cut to reality, and we see him just smashing things as Zach Galifianakis' character comes in and is like, you okay, buddy? You know, realizing that this is really happening, and it was such a cool transition. And so I always tried my best every time I'd see them, especially this second time walking around, you know, watching it again, knowing what's happening, to try to figure out, do they slip up and show reality? Like, the only times they did that purposefully was that first sequence we show it, and then the taxi scene where he's flying through the city, and he gets out, and it's obvious, like, hey, you haven't paid for the taxi yet. Yeah. I enjoyed that a lot, but I can see where that can be a little bit jarring.
Yeah, I can't exactly pinpoint why it didn't work for me. I think maybe just maybe it was just like the flying sequence that was like too fantastical for
me. That might have been it, yeah, because it was because a lot of the ones made sense, like especially when you have the Birdman character speaking to Michael Keaton, telling him how it truly is in Hollywood, which is I love that truth in general because it's such a funny thing. Because as we watch this movie, we have this, you know, the film itself is an indie film. It's very, very talkative, very, you know, provocative. It's thought invoking and all that stuff. And then we have sort of Birdman, this the Hollywood reality character, for lack of better words, saying, no one fucking cares about this shit. Mm-hmm. Come on, just all you need is just this, and we can make a fucking mint, you know?
Right.
And I think that might be why I liked a lot of those sequences more, because I like the idea of this character having this gnawing feeling of just like, look, just fucking sell out already. Just give it up. You know this isn't you. Go make another Birdman, make a ton of money, and make a whole bunch of people happy, when that sometimes isn't enough. And I like that. I might have liked those sequences more because of that inner turmoil.
Yeah, I think the Birdman character was really cool. I think maybe, and I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it, I think maybe part of my problem also was when it was building up, like, oh, this dude maybe has telekinesis. Like, I feel like maybe I was being sold on a path that didn't end up happening or satisfying where my mind was wandering. but maybe like going down the road, recontextualizing it with the purpose of Birdman himself, then maybe it'll end up landing a little bit harder on me, you know, down the road.
Yeah.
But yeah, something about that was a little off. I want to talk briefly about Zach Galifianakis.
Yes.
I loved him in this movie. My God. I mean, it's like my favorite thing. Zach Galifianakis was in is kind of a funny story, and like it was one of the first times I had kind of seen him branch out from his, hey, I'm the dude who does stand-up, and yeah. I'm this guy.
Yeah, the silly, ridiculous character.
Like, I really love that. I liked it when, you know, when Will Ferrell did, like...
Stranger Than Fiction?
Yeah, he did Stranger Than Fiction. He did another, like, super small indie kind of thing, right, which was cool. I loved it when Jim Carrey did Eternal Sunshine. Like, I really like putting these actors in roles that they are, like, very much against what they are very well known
for. Well, because I think it's a lot harder to make people laugh than it is to make people cry. It's not, and that's to say that drama isn't difficult. Drama is difficult, but to make somebody laugh like the way Zach Galifianakis has made me laugh over the years, it's very hard. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of thinking. And like even like Robin Williams before he passed, like that kind of actor too, like he'd be funny in Aladdin and things like that. And then you'd watch, you know, all his serious films. It was just like, oh, damn. Even like there was an episode, this tells you how much I enjoyed Robin Williams. There's actually an episode of Law and Order SVU that he's playing a serious role. And he like eats up the scene and just is like, holy shit, it's Robin Williams. But you're right about Zach Galifianakis, especially in this, because he's playing a little bit of comedy. Mm-hmm. But he's playing this like, I'm as much of a straight man as I can be, and trying to keep this crazy, insane former celebrity in check, because this thing is hanging on by a thread.
Yeah.
And there's a shit ton of money riding on this.
Yeah, it was good to see him show some range.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that really appeals to me about that kind of character. Also, Jack Black in that movie where he was a serial killer in Texas.
I know you're talking about.
Spoiler alert, I guess.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I think my friend Erica or Ecopoxy there online adores that movie and has told nothing about it.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. But let's talk about the other elements of this film, specifically the soundtrack.
Yeah, the sound was super cool. Like just starting right off in the beginning, the opening title screen, this awesome like what felt like a live drum performance.
Yeah.
And that kind of carried on throughout the film, especially when like the drummer would show up in like weird places on
exactly,
set.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
I love because like you realize what the soundtrack is as the movie's coming in and it's opening up the title sequence and all the letters are coming in at the points the drum hitting that or snare or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was like, I thought that was just a great technique.
Yeah.
And I just love the idea that this is going to be the thing that fuels the movie. And when things get intense, the drum gets a bit faster, a bit crazier. When things are a bit somber, it kind of backs away. And it's almost like this is the sound of the city. And I probably, out of all the things, I mean, I love the visually of the film, but I thought the soundtrack was just perfectly done for this kind of movie.
Yeah, it was so cool. Because, you know, if you came into this movie with, you know, your standard orchestral
score.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like, it just would not have felt right.
Like, even at the points when it had that, it made sense. Like, when those fantastical scenes, when it kind of busted in sort of the only orchestral thing. But I love the moment before he's in the flying sequence, and the guy comes, you know, he's like, start the music. Sir, are you all right? Like, the music stops right away. It's like, that's not reality. And that's sort of, you know, the idea being that this is all in his head and that sort of thing. But what I liked was that when it was reality, it was just this just drum. And I would like my favorite part of the drummer coming into the sequence was when it's before the final scene, before the, you know, gun to the head, that they pan quickly to, I guess, the break room, for lack of better words, and they just see the drummer there, and it just kind of goes away. It's so funny to see the drummer, because at times it makes sense for him to be in there, like, obviously in the street, makes sense for him to be here, but, like, that made no sense for him to be there, just like, oh, it's the drummer, what's he doing? Oh,
yeah.
It's just like, this is in his head still, all this is in his head. I think that's what I liked about it, was that all that stuff. What did you think about Emma Stone as a character? Only because I know, I think you've in the past said you're somewhat of an Emma Stone.
I think she's great. This one was interesting. Her character was very antagonizing.
Yeah.
And very, like, closed off and just, like, not having it. At first, I wasn't totally sure, but I think I ended up coming around on her a little bit more. It's tough to make a character like that likable and relatable and stuff.
Right.
It didn't move me in some super outstanding way, although she absolutely had her moments.
Oh, God. No, I was especially... the moments I like about her, what I like Emma Stone as a character, she is still a very, very broken person. Much like her father is broken in one way, she's broken in an entirely different way. See, her character just got out of rehab. She's sort of trying to recover from a lot of stuff. What I liked about her was that she felt like a real person. Like, she felt like she had a you know, because sometimes we have those, like, I just got a rehab character, and they're always these, the world sucks and everything else. Like, they're like, oh, I'm happy, everything's great. But I liked how she was confused. And she, you know, much like we talked in the beginning, she's trying to figure out where she fits in this whole thing. Like, you know, she's talking about her father and saying, you know, you don't even have a Facebook page, Dad. And not because that it's supposed to be snotty, it's because in her world, that is how you judge, you know, success. You judge it by how many retweets you've got, how much, you know, whether or not your content, you know, hit the analytics you needed to hit, you know, how many views, how many, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, you and I sometimes get into that sort of weird world at times. We watch one of our episodes and see, well, how many people saw it, how many people watched it, especially
like, man, people love Hey Arnold.
Yeah.
Let's keep making more of those.
Exactly. And it gets tricky like that, because hearing from her character's point of view, like, yes, that's right. And I think that's why I enjoyed her a lot, because she felt real. She felt like someone of this era, of this generation, whereas Michael Keaton was of the, well, all we have to do is make this blockbuster film kind of thing.
Yeah, she definitely had, she had, I would say, pretty much the depth of Keaton's character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe there was, well, I don't, I was going to say maybe she didn't have as many opportunities to,
yeah,
to do things, but I mean, she had plenty of good scenes.
She had some great scenes for sure. Let's get to, I think, my other favorite character, that being Edward Norton's character.
Edward Norton's pretty great.
Now, the question is, do you think Edward Norton was playing Edward Norton, or do you think he was playing a bastardized version of Edward Norton?
Yeah, I mean, I like to imagine there are shades of Edward Norton in there.
I like my favorite scene, and I don't know if it's yours, but it's my favorite scene, was he's there at the bed. He's just like, I'm getting hard. No, it's okay. I'm fine. No, I'm getting hard. Let's really fuck.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. There is something really interesting about Edward Norton's character.
Yes.
You know, the severity that he takes his onstage performances,
yeah,
as compared to real life.
Because
to him, that
is his real life.
Nothing else matters.
Right, really. And I think that's the interesting thing with his character, is that, you know, like, at one point, Emma Stone asks, do you want to fool around? And he goes, I'm scared I wouldn't be able to get it up. And he's like, why? And he's like, because on stage is where I give it. Like, it's interesting to have this guy who really gives a damn about the theater. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you know, as I'm talking about it now, all Emma Stone, Michael Keaton, and Edward Norton's character are all the same people. They all just kind of come from at different angles. You know,
yeah.
Michael Keaton wants to, quote-unquote, legitimize himself in that so he can go back to movies and get recast in the roles he's meant to be. Emma Stone wants to kind of get viral successful and get a, you know, she's expressed, like, you have 80,000 followers in you know, less than one day. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Norton wants to impress this one critic and wants to sort of make that, because there's a point where that I love the scene at the bar where he's like, only the theater matters, nothing else matters, no one knows who the hell you are in this town, I'm sorry, were you Birdman, I need to get a picture with you. And it's such a great scene, because it really shows that that's sort of what he views, is that in his world people know who he is and he wants to matter in that world, whereas Keaton, you know, all these characters want to matter in their own respective spheres.
Throughout the film, through most of the characters and most of the themes, there's a lot of darkness and like undercurrents,
yeah,
of sadness and pessimism, but it's really nice to see a film where literally every character really cares about,
yes,
something. They all have something very distinctly driving them towards their actions. Which is nice.
It's so great to see it in a movie like this, because You know, I mean, the director, first off, is a phenomenal director. He's done things like Babel and Amores Perros. Mm-hmm. And watching this movie and seeing all the stuff and all it put together, it's like someone gave a shit about a movie. And it's been a while since I've seen someone give a shit about a movie. Not to say that I haven't seen good movies in a while, but especially in this day and age now, and I liked how he did that contrast so much with the blockbuster versus the indie film. Because there are great blockbusters that we've liked. I mean, I've loved Guardians of the Galaxy and things like that. But it's really cool him saying that most people won't get this. Most people won't understand what it is that goes through your head, because most people don't understand what it is to create something, understand what it is to make something and to sort of bear your soul and everything else. And I liked how it put that contrast of like, here's the side of people like, I care about this, this is important. And the side of like, why does it matter? There's a bunch of people watching something before they go eat a meal or something like that. And that might be why I enjoy it the most, is because of that sort of undercurrent of not indie versus, you know, big budget, but more of what is it that we're doing here when we make a movie? What is it we're doing here when we create anything? What is it our mission is to do? And I think that's what I liked about the movie the most.
Yeah, the creator struggle is a very big vein that courses throughout the entire film. And I think that definitely resonated with me quite a bit as well.
Yeah, that's what I'd imagine, because when going into this film, I had gone in a bit cold. I saw the trailer. I think Zach had showed me the film, Lonely.Geek online. He had showed me the trailer, and I was like, I gotta check this movie out. This looks amazing. I don't know what the hell it's going to be, but it looks amazing. And then I'm in Dallas, and I tell my mother, you know, they wanted to go see a movie for Thanksgiving. I was like, well, they're showing Birdman. I've been hearing a lot of good things. And I was like, oh, we got to see Birdman. I was like, you've heard of this movie? Because I was surprised, because it's not a movie that I would think would have gotten a lot of buzz, would have gotten a lot of love beyond critics and things like that. It's a very much a cinema fan's movie.
And it's just weird enough to not be mainstream.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's what it was. I was like, my mother told me she wanted to watch. I was like, you know this movie? Like, that mm-hmm. put me off guard. Yeah. It just was like, I would never have thought this would be up your alley, Mom. And she loved it. My dad loved it. And I enjoyed the hell out of it. I saw it just because it was such an amazing thing of doing this one giant continuous shot idea and following the story that way, and how they transitioned time with that was amazing. Like, they mm-hmm. panned the camera up to the sky and sort of flash forward a bit and kind of pan down, how they would do all these sort of scenes. Yeah,
all of those time-lapse shots were phenomenal.
Yeah, it just was amazing how it all fit in and how they still made a cohesive story out of it, because it could have just, you know, exploded on the launch pad, so to speak. Because it's a very ambitious idea of like, well, how do we do this movie and such. And even then, there's even CG effects that are like, wow, I would not have thought of putting explosions here and things like that. And because of that contrast, I think what I enjoyed about it the most was that it really did do that all well. And it's something that rarely happens in movies.
Yeah, it was ambitious in a way that a lot of movies aren't. At some point, I think it was maybe Jeff Cannata who had mentioned that it very much feels like a play.
Yeah.
In itself, like all of the staging and all of the things. It was really fun to think about, like, they're in these super narrow corridors, and you could just imagine there's a dude like holding the camera rig, and there's a dude like doing focusing, and there's a dude behind him doing like audio.
That's the thing.
And the whole time they're like shifting in these really tight corners.
That's what I would love to see, how the hell they pulled off some of the shots.
It was really just interesting.
Because that was one thing I kept thinking about too, was like, as I'm watching the movie, like, how the fuck did they pull this off? Mm-hmm. How the fuck did they pull this shot off? This has to be wider than it is. And I don't think it was. I think, I'd be really curious to see if that was a real theater or not. I would, part of me says yes, part of me says no, but the part of me that says no, it's hard to tell. Mm. It would be hard to tell if those narrow corridors, because it felt narrow. And if it wasn't, it felt that way. Mm-hmm. And because it's this continuous shot, you're like, you're kind of on edge already, just because of the nature of not having a cut.
Yeah.
Because again, it's this very beautiful film. It's rare that I see that in theaters. It's rare that I see that in that large of a theater and getting this much praise. And it's not that I wouldn't see it being Oscar nominated. It's just like, wow. If anyone's my front runner for Oscars for Best Picture, it's Birdman right now. I think it was a phenomenal movie.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. For creators and normal people alike.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so any final thoughts? Any last things you want to say about Birdman before?
I'm excited to at some point sit down and watch it again and just like try to redigest it.
See, now that's interesting. That's interesting because it's rare. It's rare that you ever say like I'm excited to see it again. Like you might watch a movie a second time, mm-hmm. but this one you're like I'm excited to watch it again.
Yeah, I mean there are definitely a collection of films that I love to just like sit down and rewatch and just relive. But generally speaking, when I watch through it the first time, unless it like really strikes a chord with me,
right,
I'm happy to let it set for a couple of years before I revisit it. But this one definitely feels like something that I would get something out of watching it again.
Yeah, I think so too, especially me watching a second time out of theaters here digitally. It was just phenomenal. Brent, it's always a pleasure doing the show with you, sir. Where can people find the magnificent, glorious, magnanimous Brant Hughes?
You can find me on the stage, the theater of life, at twitter.com/gadwag.
Yep.
How about you?
Well, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitters. If you want to comment on the show, talk about your experience with Birdman, maybe you had an entirely different take than both Brant and I, head on over to our website, cosmicradio.tv/cinematography. There you'll find previous episodes, show links, our Twitter account. And of course, if you're watching on YouTube, hit that big old subscribe button wherever it is. Maybe it's here, maybe it's there, maybe it's around. I don't know.
Pointing in the video never works over here.
It never works.
It never works.
But I love doing it nonetheless because my dream and hope is that one day I'm going to point and the button just follows wherever I point. That's my dream and hope, is that one day I'll point, it'll be down here, and go, no, but the button just switches, and the annotation moves with it, just like, what the hell's going on? Just spins around like a jackass.
You're incorrigible.
That's my hope and dream. So that's it for today, so tune in next time, and as always, ta-ta. Cinema. Later.
I'm a bird. Music from this week's episode is provided by Panacea and K. Murdoch. You can support both over at neosonix.bandcamp.com. That's neosonix.bandcamp.com.
This has been a CosmicRadio.tv production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.